and Anti-Fascism, Reflections on the Past and Possibilities in the Present. Join us for a concert July 7th featuring Egyptian Cotton Orchestra, Montreal Free Jazz, Kim Dong Wong, free improv based on Korean traditional music, Skunk Heaven, New York City Noise, on July 7th, 2022, at 9 p.m., La Sala Rosa, 4848 Saint Laurent. For more information on the concert and conference on protest music and anti-fascism, music and antifascism.wordpress.com. This concert, with generous support from Suoni per il Popolo and Popolo Press. This is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
They want us to feel like we are diminishing in existence in Jerusalem. Our flag is almost banned at every occasion in Jerusalem. Saying you're Palestinian is akin to becoming a criminal. Sometimes if you express Palestinian identity, they suppress you by force and violently. They just want to turn the city into a Jewish settlement where Palestinians are a minority under 30%. That is the proclaimed goal of the Jerusalem municipality.
This is Rethinking Palestine, a podcast from Ashabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network. We are a virtual think tank that aims to foster public debate on Palestinian human rights and self-determination. We draw upon the vast knowledge and experience of the Palestinian people, whether in Palestine or in exile, to put forward strong and diverse Palestinian policy voices. In this podcast, we will be bringing these voices to you so that you can listen to Palestinians sharing their analysis wherever you are in the world. The Israeli regime has actively sought to destroy Palestinian Jerusalem since its creation in 1948. Over the decades, we have seen continuous and intensified attacks on the Palestinian presence in the city. Although this is in keeping with Israeli policy vis-a-vis Palestinians wherever they may be, Jerusalem certainly holds a special place in the Israeli settler colonial project, one that has led to a deteriorating trajectory for Palestinians in the city. Now, this year, we once again saw intensified attacks against Palestinians during Ramadan from Israeli regime forces. But perhaps one of the images that will stay with many of us forever is of the funeral of slain Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, which was brutally repressed by Israeli police. Coffin bearers were brutally beaten and some even arrested. But despite this horrific repression, Palestinians in their tens of thousands still attended the funeral and flooded the old city with Palestinian flags, demonstrating that despite this persistent erasure, Palestinians remain steadfast in Jerusalem. Joining me to discuss this is Jalal Abu Khater, a Palestinian writer and activist from Jerusalem. Jalal, thank you for joining me on this episode of Rethinking Palestine.
Thank you, Yara, for having me on. I'm honored.
Jalal, this is such a big topic and we can cover so much, but I really want to focus on more recent goings on. And perhaps you can start off by telling us what has happened in Jerusalem since the Unity Intifada of last year. What, if anything, has changed?
Last year, we saw a major shift in Jerusalem. The Palestinian street was visible not only in Jerusalem, but also in 48 Palestine, the West Bank, elsewhere in the world, in Gaza. There was a lot of representation for Palestine from all over Palestine and internationally. There was what we just described as the Unity Intifada, because that is what we felt. And in a way, Jerusalem was at the very center, at the very core of this Intifada, in my opinion, at least as a Jerusalemite. I saw how Jerusalem influenced people, how Jerusalem motivated and inspired others to protest for Palestine, to raise the Palestinian flag. We saw what happened in Gaza. We cannot ever forget what happened in Gaza. Gaza stood up for Jerusalem to make sure that Jerusalem does not feel alone. And we saw the onslaught Israel led against Gaza, killing innocent people and bombing buildings and homes and terrorizing the nation for weeks just because Gaza said, "We are standing with Jerusalem." We all know that was the case last year. Of course, it's normal. When time passes, people tend to relax their energies, or perhaps people tend to forget what we had just gone through. I was in Sheikh Jarrah mid last summer. I was interviewing people, speaking to them about what they expect of this new quote-unquote government of change, the Israeli government of change. There was a new government coming in place. Netanyahu was gone. And what are the people of Sheikh Jarrah expecting from this new government of change, since they were at the epicenter of the troubles in the past? Everyone shared the same response. Everyone shared the same concern and fear of this new government of change, this coalition government that Israelis established from the so-called Israeli Zionist left and right-wing parties, which together established this government. There was fear that it will be more dangerous, it will be more brutal, it will be more barbaric, and it's dealing with the Palestinians only to survive as a government in the face of Netanyahu. They wanted to convince the extreme right in Israel that we are here to represent you. This new government of change is way worse for Palestinians all over than anything we've seen before, because they want to prove to the extremes of the Israeli society that they are there for the settlers, they are there for the settler movement in Jerusalem as well. They want to return the deterrence against Palestinians. They don't want to see what they saw in Umm al-Fahm again. They don't want what happened in Lid, in Yafa, in Haifa, in Jerusalem. They want to crush the Palestinian identity and the symbolism of Palestine from our collective memory, especially over the past few months. We've seen how brutal they've been. When other commentators claim that this is a moment of calm in the Palestinian territories, they don't realize, or they don't wish to realize, or they don't wish to see that we are being killed every day, we are losing our homes every day, and there is a demolition almost every day in a certain part of Palestine, especially in areas of the West Bank and Jerusalem, occupied Jerusalem. Just this year, in Jerusalem itself, since January 2022, 75 demolitions have been recorded in Jerusalem. 39 of those are residential homes, and we're still faced with warnings that Israel is giving out to people, in Silwan, in At-Tur, in Sur Baher, and elsewhere, where they want to throw out dozens and dozens of Palestinian families from their home, make them homeless because of what they claim to be lack of permit. But in fact, they want to zone the homes of people, such as a house in Silwan and Wadi Qaddoum, a house of 12 apartments. It is housing almost 100 Palestinians, 32 adults and 42 children. Can you imagine? They want to throw those people out in the street because they claim the area is zoned to be a green area and they want to turn it into a sports field in the middle of Silwan and Wadi Qaddoum. They want to make Palestinians homeless without an alternative, of course. This is the brutality of the Israeli state. They want to throw people out on the street and claim that, oh, we're just fixing it up to make it a park or a football field. Of course, this is happening all over Jerusalem. especially in Silwan, there are many cases of people facing imminent forceful evictions from their homes because Israelis want to build biblical parks, biblical theme parks. In Wadi Helwe, actually, in Al-Bustan neighborhood, in Wadi Qaddoum, they want to demolish dozens of homes. There's, I think, approximately 100 homes in Wadi Qaddoum and Al-Bustan area, which are threatened with close imminent demolition. In order to build a park, King David City, for Jewish biblical settlers. This is to the benefit of the Israeli settler organization, Elad. We are always being faced with this. In other areas in Sheikh Jarrah and Batn al-Hawa of Silwan, settlers are taking over our homes using the courts and the legal system of Israel, which allows only Jewish settlers to claim property in East Jerusalem because of the laws that they've established to steal our homes. But at the same time, I must say that no Palestinian can reclaim their stolen home from Jerusalem. I, myself, am one of thousands of Jerusalemites who do have papers for our homes and our properties and our lands, which are now in what they call West Jerusalem. So they still continue to use the state, the legal system, to take over our homes in East Jerusalem, while we are not able to even claim back our homes that they now live in Al-Qatamon, in Al-Baqa neighborhood, in the Talbiye and other neighborhoods of West Jerusalem today. So we are faced with a war on Palestinian existence in Jerusalem. And since last year, it has only intensified. In Silwan, in Sheikh Jarrah, in Jabal Mukabber, in Sur Bahir, in Ras Al Amud, all those neighborhoods are facing threats from the municipality of Jerusalem, from the courts, from the settler movements, collectively. And the enforcers are, of course, the Israeli occupation forces in the city. They have the guns, they have the arms, they have the legal instruments, they have the bulldozers. And we Jerusalemites feel that we are also so left alone, and that's what they want. They want to us be isolated, to feel alone while they take over the city and continue to build massive projects. There's also something to add that over the past few months, we've learned about the Israelis, especially this new government, speeding up progress in different projects that are meant to accommodate Jewish settlers only. They wish to expand the settlements of Givat Hamatos, Givat HaShaked, I believe those are around Beit Safafa, which is a neighborhood in technically West Jerusalem, and Palestinian existence there is being suffocated and no one is allowed to expand and build and accommodate the growing population. But at the same time, they have two settlements in mind, thousands of settler units to be built around Beit Safafa to be choking that area and to limit Palestinian existence in that town in Jerusalem. Similarly, in Atarot, where they are speeding up the plans to build a settlement for ultra-Orthodox Jewish settlers, Atarot is situated between Beit Hanina, between Qalandia, between Kufr Aqab. They want to insert settlements right in the heart of Palestinian Jerusalem. And all of this has been happening since last year. They are just speeding up those processes. They want us to feel like we are diminishing in existence in Jerusalem. Our flag is almost banned at every occasion in Jerusalem. Saying you're Palestinian is like is akin to becoming a criminal. Sometimes if you express Palestinian identity, they suppress you by force and violently. They just want to turn the city into a Jewish settlement where Palestinians are a minority under 30%. That is the proclaimed goal of the Jerusalem municipality.
Jalal, thank you for outlining all that. What you've described is really this consistent process of erasure with destruction of Palestinian homes, the dispossession of Palestinians from their land. And it's really quite shocking that commentators and media people are able to describe this as a period of quiet or a period of calm when the reality for Palestinians is to the contrary. If you're enjoying this podcast, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org, where you will find more Palestinian policy analysis and where you can join our mailing list and donate to support our work. Jalal, you mentioned flags and how the Israeli regime gets so riled up at the sight of Palestinian flags in Jerusalem because it challenges their claim to absolute sovereignty and control. At the end of May, we all watched as thousands of Israeli settlers descended upon Jerusalem for, you know, what they call Flag Day. And you were there on the streets watching everything unfold. And usually this is a day in which settlers are given complete free rein to be violent towards Palestinians and cause damage to Palestinian property. Can you tell us, maybe, even though you have touched upon this a little bit, further tell us about what this tells us about Israeli society?
It's not just thousands, it's over 50,000. And some say the number is 70,000 of those Israeli settlers who descended upon our streets in a really violent and dark day for Jerusalem. I'll start off by saying that Israel, the whole of Israel, chose to make this happen. You had the Prime Minister of Israel, Bennett. You had the Foreign Minister, Yair Lapid, he is soon to become Prime Minister. You had the entire government of Israel, including those in Labour and other parties, supporting this march, the fact that it should happen on the route that those organizers chose. The organizers, of course, extreme. They're no longer actually extreme fringes of Israeli society. They are a mainstream in Israel, and they are a very vocal and an active group who are, in a way, influencing the direction of the Israeli state in every way. Those are not extreme fringes. Those are people who are Israeli. They are representative of a very dangerous trend in Israeli society. It is a trend of hate and violence towards anything Palestinian. So I just need to be clear with this. They chose to make this happen, this march happen. Before I describe how ugly this march was, I want to say that they chose to make it happen. They are responsible. They made statements. They were given warnings by international parties. Even the Americans were trying to influence the Israelis to change the route of this march. The Americans tried to intervene. Lots of countries in the world, they all know what this march means, and we've seen it before. It's not like a rare event. We've seen it before. If they allow this hate march to happen, they are responsible for it. And the way I see it, the violence we saw, this is state-sponsored violence, state-sponsored terrorism against the Palestinians, and as if it was an open season on Palestinians in Jerusalem. As if the Israeli state, which is in control of the entirety of Jerusalem today, by force, of course, it's an occupied city, as if they declared open season on Palestinians. Violence was permitted against Palestinians and not vice versa, of course, because I've seen with my own two eyes how Jewish settlers would be throwing stones at me and others and homes of people in Jerusalem. And the Israelis would be defending them, protecting them, and also arresting us for trying to defend ourselves. I've seen this with my own two eyes in Jerusalem. And I think one commentator on Twitter, she described the scenes of Jerusalem as if it's something out of the Purge, because for one day, violence was allowed, permitted by the state of Israel against Palestinians. I saw it in the old city of Jerusalem against journalists, against Palestinian residents. We saw it in Silwan at night, thousands of settlers attacking homes with rocks and damaging cars and hurting people. People were hospitalized because of this violence, which was facilitated by the forces of the Israeli state. In Sheikh Jarrah, it was even worse. It was an organized pogrom. It was very clearly an organized pogrom, which the Israeli police did not intervene to stop. And it led to the damage of people, homes, property. People were injured, taken to hospital as well. Jewish settlers were attacking people in the thousands. And it happened from, I think, the evening when we first heard the news. I was in Jerusalem around 6 p.m. until 12. There was reported attacks against Palestinians, against Palestinian homes in Sheikh Jarrah. And the Israeli police forces did not stop it. In fact, when we first heard that there was organized attack against Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah during this flag march they were holding in Jerusalem, I was in Salah al-Din Street. And I remember people just heard immediately about the news. I heard people on phones, speakers from the cars. They were reporting that there is organized violence against Palestinians in Sheikh Jarrah. Settlers are attacking in huge numbers. So people naturally mobilized to go protect the people of Sheikh Jarrah. We went down from Shara Salah al-Din, just maybe a couple of 100 meters. We were met with extreme violence by the Israeli forces in the area. There was a water cannon sent against us. There was rubber bullets being fired. Police deployment was heavy. I was there in Sheikh Jarrah, and I saw from a distance how settlers were still continuing to throw stones and attack Palestinians in their homes. Israeli police forces were not stopping any settler, were not making any arrests. Zero arrests were made that day. There was organized violence against Palestinians, and zero arrests were made. Only two reported arrests of Israeli settlers in Jerusalem were of two settlers. They were masked. They attacked a journalist called Iyad Harb. He works with the Israeli public broadcaster Kan, and he is the police correspondent. He is a Druze journalist from the north, and it's as if it's one of them. It's an Israeli journalist, technically. There was outrage among Israeli journalists how this one journalist got attacked, and there was videos of him. He was describing himself like he was beaten with sticks on his head, metal rods on his head. His phone was stolen, his clothes were ripped, and he was violently beaten. He himself, Iyad Harb, said that two officers of the Israeli border police were nearby, 10 meters away, and they did not intervene to stop the attack against him until after the two masked settlers ran away and he was screaming in pain. And that's when they came to attend to see what happened with this journalist who got attacked in front of their eyes. This happened repeatedly in East Jerusalem, especially in Sheikh Jarrah. People from their homes, drivers, cars were smashed. It looked and felt everything screamed of an organized pogrom. People were preoccupied with the march and Damascus Gate and the Old City, that we didn't expect thousands to descend upon Sheikh Jarrah in this organized manner and to go smash homes and smash people's homes and cars without them being stopped by the presence of the Israeli forces in the area. It felt like a state-sponsored attack. And that's what happened on that march. They chose to let this happen. The Israelis knew that there would be genocidal chants. There would be calls for death for Arabs. I heard death for Arabs being screamed at multiple occasions, and I got called a liar by one officer who was trying to kick me out of the area. He said, "Enta shakran." Shakran means liar in Hebrew. I had to learn that day. And I told him, like, "You're just pushing us away and throwing us out while you allow those settlers to call death for Arabs and call us Benzona and all the worst names in the world and protect them." There is a collusion that we saw on that day. There is collusion between the State of Israel, its armed forces, and those extremists, which, if it's like 70,000 people on the streets raising the Israeli flag and yelling death to Arabs, those are not extremists. Those are not the fringes. It's 70,000 settlers. They're representing the Israeli state. And the Israeli state is represented by those who allowed this to happen, who deployed 3,000 Israeli occupation forces in Jerusalem to protect those people, to allow their violence to continue. And all the evidence we have, all the videos we have, no arrests were made. Any Palestinian who dared to resist, who dared to raise a Palestinian flag in their face, got attacked, got shot. Dozens, even more than 70 or 80, got arrested. Many were hospitalized. The damage, property damage, is in millions, I believe. It just looked like a day where, from the movie The Purge, if you're a Jewish settler, you're allowed to go be violent against Palestinian subjects, and you get scot-free just on this day. That's what it felt like.
Jalal, thank you for sharing your sort of eyewitness testimony of what happened on that day and what has been happening on other days in Jerusalem. And you're right to point out that this is not a fringe group of Israelis. This is a large, if not majority, portion of the Israeli population. You know, commentators were saying, oh, this is only a minority. This doesn't represent the state of Israel. And yet the Israeli Prime Minister Bennett is a champion of settlers in the 67 territories. And yet the Israeli regime was founded on the dispossession and the theft of Palestinian land. It is in the very foundation and the DNA of the Israeli regime to dispossess Palestinians and to be violent towards Palestinians that remain steadfast. I want to shift gears a little bit just for the end of this episode and talk about other ways in which Israel tries to eliminate Palestinian presence in the city. And one successful and really cruel mechanism that they use is ID revocation. And thousands of Palestinian Jerusalemites have had their residency in Jerusalem revoked since 1967. And often many of these cases are a form of punishment for political activity. Now, one very recent example of such a case is that of Salah Hamouri, a Palestinian-French Jerusalemite lawyer and human rights defender, who is currently being held under administrative detention following having his residency revoked. Can you tell us a little bit more about this case?
Just as I was speaking about Salah, I want to mention that only a few days ago, I saw a video of a Palestinian Jerusalemite from Silwan. His name is Murad Abbasi. He was having a farewell breakfast with his family because he had received this, in my opinion, the most brutal and violent of legal orders. The Israeli state wanted to expel him from Jerusalem. So he is forcibly removed from Jerusalem and he has to reside in the West Bank, away from his home, away from his family, away from his kids. Murad Abbasi is one of many Palestinians who are punished and persecuted for their political activity. This is called political persecution. He's one of many who have been forced to leave Jerusalem just because they are deemed to be a threat to the Israeli state without any evidence, without any justification, without any material evidence, but their existence as politically active Palestinians is threatening to the Israeli state, and that's why they make orders to expel them from Jerusalem. Of course, we have Salah Hamouri as well, a human rights defender and a lawyer. I think it's called breach of allegiance. So they accuse Salah Hamouri of breaching the allegiance to the state of Israel, which is ridiculous. We are an occupied people living under occupation, and they assume that they can use in the courts claim breach of allegiance to revoke our right to live in Jerusalem, the right to reside in the city, and they get the right to forcefully evict us from the city as well. Salah has been arrested, not even just had his ID revoked by court. He's been arrested and is under administrative detention, which means he is detained without charge or trial, basically. He was there for 3 months in March, arrested for 3 months, and only a few days ago, his detention was extended for a further 3 months. Administrative detention could be extended for God knows how long. That's why people go on hunger strike to protest this inhumane measure, where people are detained without charge, without proper trial, and they are unaware of when their detention would end. It keeps extending, either 3 months, 6 months, 3 months, 6 months, and they have to just keep waiting until the Israelis decide to let them go. Sometimes it takes years before they are let go. Salah Hamouri is punished because of his commitment to Palestinians, his commitment to human rights, his commitment to his work as a lawyer with Al-Damir. Many other Palestinians, especially those who are active politically, especially those who run for parliament, for example. In the past, we've seen people who have run for Tashri'i, the Palestinian parliament, and they were as well forcefully removed from Jerusalem through the Israeli legal instruments. Of course, we're not unaware that Israel is an enemy of democracy. Israel does not allow an election to happen in Jerusalem. They don't want anyone Palestinian to participate in elections in Jerusalem. They've denied us the right to elect parliamentarians over the past few years in Jerusalem, which is the excuse the PA uses not to hold any elections. But there hasn't been any election held in Jerusalem. We are not represented by anyone in Jerusalem. We are stateless people living under the mercy of this brutal occupation force. Even if you hold democracy in the West Bank, like yesterday I saw a banner in front of the Albire municipality. It's a banner in support of Islam Tawil, the mayor of Albire. He got elected as the mayor of Albire. But before he got elected, when all the signs were indicating that he will win, his group will win for the Albire municipal elections, he got arrested the night before, and he remains in prison. Administrative detention as well, without charge or trial, and he remains in prison as elected mayor of Albire. So Israelis do not respect any wish for Palestinians to practice democracy. We're not allowed this basic right to choose our people, choose who leads our municipalities, our town halls, our city councils. We do not have the right that of that for that anywhere, not just Jerusalem, as we've seen elsewhere in the West Bank. So democracy, it's just a cover-up for Israel to proclaim that they are a state that deserves the respect of other nations. But at the same time, we've seen how brutal apartheid is, how brutal their subjugation of Palestinians. And this hole, this really black hole, it will keep sucking and sucking and sucking until it will explode eventually. I don't believe Israel can maintain this really oppressive and subjugating regime. I don't believe they can maintain this oppressiveness, because at the same time, I want to be optimistic. I am optimistic. I believe the Palestinians are proclaiming and are addressing and are speaking up for Palestine. We are raising the Palestinian flag. Every attempt to take away our flag is met with more attempts to raise the Palestinian flag. We've seen in Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral in Jerusalem how the Palestinian flag in the thousands was filling up the streets of Jerusalem. I never imagined that scene to be. And just for context, during the funeral of Shireen Abu Akleh in Jerusalem, the flags you saw raised in that funeral, that was not an easy task. Whenever you saw a flag, you had to know this took a huge toll from the person who carried that flag and got it to that point. I myself am witness to how oppressive they were in taking away the flags. Myself, I had kept a flag in my pocket. I walked through all the old city 3 hours before the planned time of the funeral. I got to the church just in time. I didn't want to get stopped at any checkpoint because there were so many checkpoints. Trust me. They tried to block people from reaching the old city. They tried to block people from participating in this funeral. At the same time, the flags were there. I know outside of the church, while I was inside, I know there were undercover police who at one moment they would put on the caps that say police and they would start grabbing all the Palestinian flags from the crowd. They would take away all the flags and just violently assault anyone who resists, take away all the flags and then get out of the crowd. That kept happening throughout the day. And we still saw flags. We still saw large flags being raised. I myself raised a flag at the very entrance of Jaffa Gate, Bab al-Khalil. I don't think I've ever been prouder of myself. For 40 seconds, I had managed to hold the flag with my two hands over my head and speaking and chanting with people in the funeral. We were chanting, Hiya, 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 Al-Quds Arabiya. And it felt amazing. It felt like a magical moment. It was a Palestinian Jerusalem. We all saw it for what it is. 30, 40 seconds before the flag was snatched away by Israeli forces in the crowd, I saw people getting assaulted, kids had their flags snatched. I saw an old lady get assaulted and they tried to assault her and arrest her just because she had a flag with her. They were within the crowd taking away all the flags, but the picture came out with so many flags, thousands of flags in Jerusalem. I kept seeing flags as far as I walked. I kept walking out and then I'm like regretting losing my flag after 40 seconds. But at the same time, I saw like 10 or 20 in front of me. I was like, wow, like I was just astonished at how resilient those people were. People jumped checkpoints, people jumped walls, jumped fences to get to that point in the funeral. And they had massive flags with them. How did they get that? It just shows you the resilience of the Palestinians in Jerusalem. Flag is alive, the people are alive, and I don't believe that Israel will succeed in erasing Palestinian existence in Jerusalem. On the contrary, we're just going to become stronger and we are going to exert ourselves in a very confident manner soon, I believe. And inshallah soon, yani, free Jerusalem, free Palestine.
Jalal, there's really nothing that I can add to end. So thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for your testimony and thank you for your analysis. And we hope to have you again on Rethinking Palestine very soon.
Thank you, Yara.
Thank you for listening to Rethinking Palestine. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review. For more policy analysis and to donate to support our work, please visit our website, www.al-shabaka.org. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
Is there a place? Is there a place? Is there a place, is there a place where we can be more than thunderclaps and hashtags? A place where we are human, and our fears not Twitter storms, our flesh not dissected in comment sections. Is there a place, is there a place where we can be more, more than thunderclaps and hashtags? A place where we are human and our fears not Twitter storms, our flesh not dissected in comment sections. Is there a place? Is there a place where we can hold each other in sorrow and silence in defiance, in sorrow and silence in defiance before you make a picture funeral to share widely another name fallen? Is there a place? Is there a place where the headlines don't hate us or assume that we mysteriously die, just fall, and are never killed intentionally by soldiers taking orders intentionally, by snipers taking aim intentionally, by companies making war intentional? Is there a place where the headlines don't hate us? Is there a place where the headlines don't hate us? And our life, like our laughter, is intentional. Is there a place? Is there a place I don't have to justify how our lives are also sacred? Our lives also matter, and we also love our children. Is there a place where the breaking news, like breaking waves, doesn't just bring more bodies from the Mediterranean? Is there a place? Is there a place? Is there a place where we are more than horror stories and numbers etched on helmets? Stars for generals who calculate the calories to the brink of life. Is there a place? Is there a place? Is there a place? Is there a place? Nothing extraordinary, nothing magical about its oranges, nothing too blue about its skies, just a place where we can be, just a place where we can sit under a tree, just a place where we can be, where where we can be, where we can be.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Deanna Bhutu. The boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement is a Palestinian-led movement for freedom, justice, and equality. It was inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement. Since its formal launch in 2005, the BDS movement has had a major impact on ending international support for Israeli apartheid, with companies now divesting from or not investing in Israel, including companies like Ben & Jerry's. Owing to the strength of the BDS movement, Israel has sought to break it. In 2016, Israel revamped its Ministry of Strategic Affairs to specifically combat the BDS movement. In its first year alone, Israel spent $50 million on anti-BDS activities. These activities include the establishment of a, quote, tarnishing unit, unquote, aimed at destroying the careers of Palestine activists and human rights defenders, and also attempts to outlaw BDS worldwide, but particularly in the U.S. and in Germany. To date, 33 U.S. states have passed anti-BDS laws, which are laws that aim to stop individuals and companies from securing contracts if they support the BDS movement. It is in this light that the Just Vision film titled Boycott is made. Boycott follows the attempts to challenge these anti-BDS laws in a number of U.S. states, including Texas, Arkansas, and Arizona. Boycott premiered on November 14, 2021 at DOC New York. Since its premiere, it has been screened in over 20 locations across the globe, with some major screenings such as the 2022 South by Southwest Film Festival and the Human Rights Watch Festival in London. We're joined today by the film's director, Julia Basha, and one of the individuals who challenged this anti-boycott policy, Bahia Amawi. Bahia is a speech pathologist who worked with school children in Texas and who was forced to sign a clause in her contract stating that she would not boycott Israel. And if she did not sign this clause, she was not allowed to keep her job. Bahia chose not to sign the contract and instead challenged these anti-BDS laws. We hear how these laws began, the impact of these boycott laws on Bahia and others, and how these laws are serving as a template for other laws aimed at trying to curb boycotts against other companies, such as those involved in the gun industry or in fossil fuels. Boycott will be showing this week on June the 10th in Berlin for the EU premiere as part of the Hijacking Memory Conference. Bahia Amawi, how are you? Welcome to This is Palestine.
Thank you for having me.
So Bahia, tell me a little bit about yourself and the work that you do as a speech pathologist.
Yeah, so I evaluate children with speech and language disorders. I work mainly in the early childhood, so kids from 3 to 5 years old. And I'm also, I'm bilingual. I also do I evaluate students who have Arabic as their home language survey. So I'm actually quite a valuable member of the team at the Pflugerville Independent School District, because they don't have an Arabic bilingual speech language pathologist. And it really helps to have someone that speaks the language, native language of the student. So you can differentiate between dialect versus disorder.
And you're also the mother of 4 children?
Yes, I have 4 children and I actually homeschool them. So, so they're a big part of my life.
So as we see in this film Boycott, you were presented with a contract to continue your work with the school district. And in the contract, there is a clause regarding boycott of Israel. Can you tell me just a little bit about the contract and that clause, and when you first saw that clause that was in there?
Yeah, sure. So it was in 2018. I remember it vividly, actually. It's been about after 9 years of working with Pflugerville Independent School District. And I have had usually really a version of the contract every single year. But in 2018, I had signed the original contract. And then 2 weeks later, an addendum was added. Even my supervisor had not seen it. And she told me just to look over and sign it. That was when I first was aware of this addendum. And as I'm going through it, it's quite lengthy. It's about 7-8 pages. and it's a lot of, you know, legal jargon. So I don't really understand it. It took me a while. So I told her I need a couple, you know, a week at least to go through it. So I know exactly what I'm, you know, signing. And so as I'm reading through it, you know, it looked like at first initially typical, you know, clauses for, you know, equal employment, Clean Water Act, things of normal things, until I saw the word Israel. And at first I thought maybe I'm seeing something. I didn't like, I was kind of did not believe it. And I was like, that would make no sense. Why would that word be in my contract? And I look closer and it's there. And I literally just, I pause and I scream, actually. It was, my kids came downstairs and they're like, what's the matter? I go, tell me if I'm seeing something incorrectly. Do you see the word Israel? I'm like, yep, that's the word Israel. Because to me, it was just shocking how this, you know, the foreign country had to do anything with my job as a speech language pathologist in elementary school setting in Pflugerville Independent School District in Texas, out of all places. So I didn't see a connection at all between my job and a foreign country. So it was, I was baffled by it. And then when I read the clause and it stated that I must confirm that currently do not boycott or will boycott during my time working with the state. And I already had boycotted, so I'm already would have been in violation of that, of the clause already. And that was the first time I experienced it. And so I called up my supervisor the next day and I told her, listen, I can't sign this part at all. It's against my free speech, First Amendment right. And it's against my principles, since, you know, I cannot do it consciously because I am Palestinian and I cannot be complicit to what's happening there. And she understood, actually. I've been working with her for so long and I know her well. And she's like, just cross over and initial. You know, so I did that. And unfortunately, it wasn't enough. I mean, she tried to help me to go around it. But at the end, they came back and they said, if you don't sign it, you cannot return back to work. And that was basically the force, you know, of me leaving my work. I was forced to leave my work at that moment.
And so didn't, you know, other people that he would see the clause and probably just tick it off and say, oh, how are they ever going to enforce this anyway? Did that thought ever cross your mind?
It did not. You know, when I saw it, I was just really offended, so offended as an American citizen and as a Palestinian. As an American, you know, I was offended because here I have my First Amendment right that I am entitled to as an American citizen, like any other American. And just because I advocate for something the government does not share it with my ideas, they have no right to deny me that. So that was, to me, was offensive, and it just aggravated me even more. And in fact, as a Palestinian, I was offended because here is another way of dehumanizing us and delegitimizing our struggle and our self-determination. So it, to me, it was a kind of, you know, two-way where I'm just, I have to do something about it. I could not, you know, let it just go, you know, past. And in fact, I was worried also that if I let this go, then, you know, this can evolve into something even more greater. I mean, what if they prevented my children from, before registering to college, they have to sign this, you know, this clause. It could evolve into something more greater because obviously, you know, BDS is working. So they have to find a way to combat it. And that's how we know it's working, BDS, because they're coming up with laws and different ideas to try to stop it. And I was worried that it may evolve and get to the state colleges and that students were required to sign it before registering.
And what about your family? Were they supportive or not supportive of you not signing?
My husband was my rock. He was definitely supportive all the way. And the kids were like kind of confused or like they didn't understand what's, you know, this is something new to them. They're only very young at that time. Amazingly, it was a long time ago. It seems like it was just yesterday, but it was really a long time ago. And my son actually was like, Mom, just sign it. Nobody's going to know. But, you know, I told him, no, I would know and God would know. And that's enough for me. And I wanted them to be an example for them that they're just as American as anybody else. And no one has a right to stomp over their First Amendment, that they are equal in exercising these First Amendment rights. And just because you are Palestinian does not mean you're not allowed to use it or you're advocating for Palestinian justice, you're not allowed to use it. I didn't want them to be vilified as Palestinians. We're already, that's being done, you know, in a great deal here in America, in the history books, in schools, on the news. So I did not want them to feel always vilified. And as their mom, I want to make sure that I protect them and they feel, you know, proud of their heritage and their country.
It sounds like you were out of work for some time. How long were you unable to work?
So a whole year, actually, because this was the beginning of the school year. This was in, I want to say early September, like the first week of September maybe happened. So the whole year I did not work until we had received the deliberation all the way at the end in May by the judge, which ruled in our favor, thank God. But by that time, school was already out. They did issue me another contract, gratefully, without the clause in it, but I wouldn't be able to work again until the fall, obviously. So that year, a lot of children lost an important service. And that's just really sad that our state, our government would, you know, prefer to support an apartheid, oppressive, settler colonialism country instead of supporting their own people and upholding the Constitution. It was really a sad moment in what our government was doing at that time.
And presumably it also impacted you financially.
Thank God my husband works full time. To me, this it wasn't for me a job for means of finance. It was really a means of me still being involved in my field, which I worked hard, you know, to achieve the degree in. And it's a service that I know is needed. Being a speech language pathologist is very gratifying and satisfying. You know, actually before I did my bachelor's in advertising and I worked in that for a little bit of time, but I didn't see any satisfaction in it. And so I was never felt, you know, any motivation to go to work. There's no gratitude involved in it. So I went back to school because I wanted something that makes me feel good when I get up in the morning, I look forward to. And this does that.
So, Bahia, tell me a little bit about your family in Palestine. Where are they?
So my family, we're from a tiny village near Turkerim. It's called Bala. Both my parents are from, my mom and dad are from that village. We lived there a few years when I was younger. And then every summer we would go and spend the whole summer there with our grandparents and our cousins. And, you know, it was actually one of my favorite moments and most pleasurable moments I had as a child. I enjoyed visiting there always and spending my time there. The house, my grandma's house and grandfather home, they were, would have 50 people in the house. We know everybody would come and visit and stay there. And it was just one of those things you don't forget. You know, it was different life, of course, than in America. Of course, they were didn't have the same luxuries, but amazingly, we had each other's company and it was just...
That's wonderful. So now that you've won, do you think that there's going to be an appeal?
They tried to appeal it, but it didn't go through. So it was still upheld that my law, that for contracts, individuals, it would still stand that they're allowed to boycott and that the law does not apply to contractors. However, they amended the law. That's what they did. They amended the law, and that's what they've been doing in many different states where plaintiffs have won, like in Arkansas and Arizona. They amend the laws and they change it to the ones individually, those who are impacted. So instead of individuals being impacted, they change it to companies of $100,000 or more or 10 employees or more. So currently the law in Texas now applies only to companies. And even though we had an actual company who did sue the state of Texas as well in Houston, but the judge ruled that only he is allowed to still boycott, but no one else, because no one else is impacted by this. So it was kind of confusing, the deliberation. I mean, he kind of won, you know, still currently available, the law is still here, but it didn't entirely repeal the law because it's present in Texas. However, it doesn't apply to this one company because he is from Gaza.
And how did your family react to the decision?
Oh, they were all elated, of course, you know, especially my son, after we have gone through the whole entire year. And it was a very busy year with a lot of, you know, talking to representatives. I took him with me, actually, when we spoke to representatives to try to encourage them to not to sign for the amended version. And, you know, all the many interviews and the events we went to kind of bring attention to this law. At the end, he told me, Mom, I'm really proud of you and I'm glad you didn't sign it. So I felt like this was a learning curve for them. I feel like I did my job as a mom, making sure that they, you know, continue in our legacy in this fight for self-determination.
Well, thank you very much, Bahia. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm sure they are proud of you. We're grateful that you took on that you rose to the challenge and of course that you succeeded. Thank you.
Yeah, thank God.
I want to turn now to the director of the film Boycott, Julia Basha. Julia, welcome to This is Palestine.
Thank you so much for having me.
What inspired you to put this together?
I've been working as a documentary filmmaker together with the team at Just Vision for 18 years now. And all of our films up until Boycott were focused on the stories of Palestinians and Israelis in the region. But over the past few years, we've noticed a troubling trend of laws starting in Israel and then being exported to countries in Europe and the United States that are crushing dissent and trying to prevent, whether it's Palestinians or Israelis or Europeans or Americans, from advocating on behalf of Palestinian human rights. The anti-boycott laws in the United States that have now passed in 33 states and are affecting regular American citizens like Bahia Maui were, I think, the tipping point for us that really alarmed us, because these laws were allowed to pass with very little public scrutiny or debate. If you talk to the vast majority of Americans today, they have no idea that this law applies to them. They have no idea that their right to protest a foreign country is being taken away from them quietly. And we felt we needed to sound the alarm bells. When we learned that there was a number of Americans from different political backgrounds who were challenging these bills and taking the bills to court, saying that, you know, the anti-boycott bills violated their First Amendment rights, we felt we had a great narrative thread to follow.
And so what were some of the challenges that you faced when putting together this film? I saw some of it in the credits, but if you can just spell it out for our listeners.
We wanted very much to ground the film on the experiences of Americans who are being directly affected by these bills. Oftentimes, when we talk about laws that are being passed, it can feel abstract. But when you understand that, you know, these are clauses showing up on contracts of architects, engineers, teachers, street sweepers, speech therapists, lawyers across the country, and the chilling effect that this have on individuals who want to be able to keep their jobs while also being able to advocate for causes that are important for them, I think it was really important to have that personal journey on the film. And we really wanted to explore how come these laws were able to pass in 33 states with the vast majority of Americans having no idea that this happened. Who was behind it? How did it come about? And so the film also has an investigative thread where we look at the interest groups and the flow of money that allowed these bills to be very effectively passed around and how little scrutiny they were given. I think one of the challenges of putting together a film like this, number one, is you're following, you know, lawsuits that you don't know where they're going to go, right? We filmed several plaintiffs over 3 years, and it's a leap of faith, and you have to trust your gut that things are going to develop in a way that will provide a compelling narrative arc. And the second thing is we are focusing on interest groups that really want this to stay quiet. So, you know, gaining access, getting people to talk to us, and protecting our access and our ability to tell this film in a way that can be then successfully distributed was one of the concerns that throughout the production we were keeping an eye out for.
One thing that struck me, Julia, is the way that this legislation is also impacting other areas in the United States and other laws. And in one scene, it's mentioned that this then serves as a template for other bills, mostly bills that are supportive of big corporations that are right-wing leaning. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. We saw the writing on the wall when these bills started passing. When we were in production, it was a theoretical idea that the anti-boycott bills targeting Americans who want to advocate for Palestinian human rights could be used as a template to attack Americans advocating for other social justice issues that are important to them. By the time we finished the film and we were locking picture, these new bills had already started coming into real life. So currently, right now, you have bills across several states that say that if you want to boycott the fossil fuels industry because you're interested in protecting our planet from being destroyed, you cannot keep your job with the state anymore. Companies that have decided to adopt screens so that they won't be invested in fossil fuels or in other industries that are contributing to global warming, those companies can no longer receive investment from public pension funds in states like Texas. Similarly, there are bills that say that if you want to boycott the firearms industry because you want to create gun safety in America, and we've seen the tragedy that just happened in Texas over the past week, now you cannot boycott the firearms industry. And all of these bills were modeled after the anti-BDS bill. Now, currently, the new bills are only supported by Republicans, but the anti-BDS bill was passed with bipartisan support. So Democrats who are now trying to attack Republicans for trying to take away the right of Americans to protest really need to take a hard look at how they are themselves responsible for opening the Pandora's box.
So, Julia, what's next for you and for Just Vision?
So we are currently in the film festival circuit with Boycott. We have been showing the film around the country. We've been to Texas at South by Southwest. We were in Arizona. We were in Montana and Ohio and D.C. and New York. We were in Canada at Hot Docs. We will, in the fall of 2022, start doing community and educational screenings of the film. We would like to bring it to houses of worship and campuses, community groups, think tanks. We're going to have a congressional screening. So anyone who is listening, who is interested in bringing Boycott to their communities, we would love to hear from them. They can get in touch with us at info@justvision.org. We are in the immediate future, next week on June 8th and June 9th, we have screenings in London. June 10th, we have a big screening in Berlin. Our team will be there for both of these screenings. And the goal is to really connect the dots because anti-boycott bills are now coming to the UK. About a month ago, there was an amendment introduced that also bring anti-boycott laws to the United Kingdom. And that's still at the early stage. And there's a lot of organizers in the UK who want to learn lessons from what happened in America and how to fight these bills. So we want to bring this film to Europe to really broaden the conversation around the attempts to take away the right to protest a foreign government that is spreading around the globe.
Well, I thank you both for all of your work on this. Bahia, thank you for taking this on and for showing your conviction, your courage. Thank you, Julia, for putting together a very brilliant film and for following up with this and for educating us, not only about what the anti-boycott movement is doing, but its links to other anti-social justice movements. I think that is very, very, very important. So thank you both for speaking with us today.
Thank you. I want to say it's an honor for me to be part of this documentary. It's really, I was very grateful that they asked me to be part of it. And Just Vision has been extremely respectful of our privacy and our time. And for me, this documentary is a validation that I was on the right side of the law. And because it's, you know, they've tried to silence me, the politicians started to silence me and threaten my job and censor me. But here now, I'm only speaking, I can speak only, I can speak to people at my work regarding this anywhere I want to, but I'm actually educating the entire world regarding Palestine, self-determination, and the issue over there. So I'm extremely grateful to be part of this. This has been an amazing experience, and I encourage people to see it.
Well, you're not just on the right side of the law, Bahia. Both you and Julia are on the right side of history. And I think if anything, people are going to look back at this period and say, how did this even happen? So I thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that's it for us for today. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Politica is thrilled to announce the theatrical release of
The following is a previously broadcast program.
You're listening to archival content from CKUT 90.3 FM's Time Capsule. Check out ckuttimecapsule.wordpress.com for more.
Good evening and welcome to Queer Core on CKUT 90.3 FM or ckut.ca on the web. This is the special Perversité edition of our show. It is Monday, August 10th. About 25 years ago, on July 16th, 1990, a mostly queer after-hours party called Sex Garage, which was held in the Old Port of Montreal, was raided by police. The raid involved intense and homophobic police violence and a number of arrests. The reaction to these raids, which included a kiss-in and a number of protests and demonstrations, would lead to a new relationship between queer people and the public, as well as the formation of the now no longer existent Diversité, Montreal's first LGBTQ Pride Festival. Tonight, we'll hear from QueerCore alumni Poilo Deer and photographer Linda Don Hammond, whose photos were instrumental in holding the police accountable for their violence and publicizing the events that happened at night. So don't touch that dial. This is QueerCore on CKUT 90.3 FM or ckut.ca on the web. And we're going to start by putting you back in the vibe of those Sex Garage parties with The Boy Who Couldn't Keep His Clothes On, the Banji Girlfriend Beats remix by the Pet Shop Boys. Stay tuned.